We're on page 9 of the notes. I talked last night about the Act, Declaration, and Testimony of 1761. It looks like this. It's about 170 pages of fine print. And I mentioned the fact that in order to be a member of the Reformed Presbyterian Church, you had to give your assent to all that was in this book. So it was a weighty thing for, if you would think of a person not raised in the church, to come to know all of this and then to say that he agreed with it. In those days, the terms of communion included this statement, statement number 4. This was one of the requirements for church membership: an acknowledgement that public social covenanting is an ordinance of God and obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament dispensation, that the National Covenant of Scotland and the Solemn League and Covenant of Scotland, England, and Ireland were an exemplification of this divine institution, and that these solemn deeds are a perpetual obligation upon the moral person as continued by representation and accession. I think the latter says representation. We are the representatives of those who have gone before, and accession means some others have more recently become a part of the church. And then in consistency with this, acknowledging the renovation of these covenants at Arkansas, 1712. And then the next one includes an approval of the Judicial Act, Declaration, and Testimony emitted by the Reformed Presbytery in North Britain, 1761. So, approval of the covenants and of this document. Well, we'd gotten to the point of 1811, the organization of the Synod, quite small still, but large enough that they could divide into three presbyteries, and then the three presbyteries once a year would come together for a synod meeting. So, small growth, but significant, with the consideration they started out very small. I wanted to talk about William Symington. He was a Scottish minister ordained in 1819, had two pastorates. Stranraer is one of the two remaining Scottish congregations. It's down on the southwest coast of Scotland. And his other pastorate, where he had his most significant ministry, was in Glasgow. And he was there for quite a long time. And William Symington became really a national figure. This was the time period in which the Free Church of Scotland separated from the main Church of Scotland. And Symington was a close personal friend of the leaders of that free church movement, of people like Thomas Chalmers and William Cunningham and James Bannerman and other folks like that. The Free Church was a very large and influential church after it left the Church of Scotland, and William Symington was very closely associated with those events and encouraging of that separation from the Church of Scotland. He had a very large congregation in Glasgow, and they were engaged in extensive missionary and evangelistic work in the city of Glasgow. You may know the name of John G. Payton. I mention him here, who grew up in that congregation under Symington's ministry and was involved in the mission work in the city of Glasgow in the poor districts of the city before he went out to the New Hebrides islands as a missionary. And then he wrote, as you may know, a two-volume autobiography about his mission work. And that's one of the missionary classics. It's known by many people outside of the RP Church. I think it's a commendable thing that before he became a missionary in a foreign land, he was a missionary at home. It's often been said that crossing an ocean doesn't make you a missionary. And he was discipled by Symington and involved practically in the work before he went abroad. Brad?
Just going to mention, I was at a John Piper missions conference and was listening with, I was a little tired, and all of a sudden he was talking about John G. Payton and the Reformed Presbyterian Church.
Well, okay.
And it was just kind of a shock.
Okay. Well, Brad's pastor, Roy Blackwood, did his doctoral work on the life and the writings of William Symington. And whether consciously or unconsciously, I think probably consciously, I think Roy has modeled his ministry after what he learned about William Symington. So the impact of Symington had significant impact in his own day in Scotland, and by means of Roy's study of his life, that impact has come over to our church, our own church in this country. He wrote two significant works, The Atonement and Intercession of Christ, and then Messiah the Prince. Roy Blackwood, in his dissertation, thinks that there's a great significance about the order of those books. So he first focuses attention on the saving work of Christ, and then in connection with that went on to study the mediatorial kingship of Christ. We were having a conversation at supper. The difficulty has often been that when people get concerned about how we apply the kingship of Christ to political and social matters, there's a danger of leaving behind the gospel and just being concerned about social transformation. And so the very books that Symington wrote, I think, are a safeguard against that. Be clear about the meaning of Christ's saving work, and then on the basis of that, you can talk about the outworkings of that in people responding in their whole life, including in their political life. And the book Messiah the Prince is probably the classic treatment of the mediatorial kingship of Christ. It was published in Britain first, but then later was published in this country by the National Reform Association in the 1860s. Well, we talked last night about the fact that the Covenanters had taken a position of strict separation from both the Church of Scotland and the political government of Scotland, and so they adopted the position that we call political dissent. No swearing of an oath of allegiance to the government, no recognition at that point of the government of Britain as a legitimate government, that is, with authority from God, no holding office, because holding office would require an oath of allegiance, and no voting for those who would hold office, because that would involve in a sense, appointing them as your representative to act in your name. And the belief was that that involved you in responsibility for the oath that those office holders took. So a position of political dissent. Now, before 1832, that was for most of the Scottish Covenanters not much of a practical issue, because most of them did not have the right to vote. Voting was connected with the ownership of land by and large, and the people who made up the Reformed Presbyterian Church were from the working classes, were tenant farmers for the most part, not owners of their own land. And so very few of them before 1832 had a right to vote. So it was sort of a non-issue, theoretically a prohibition of it, but most of them couldn't have voted anyway. But that changed in 1832 when there was a reform bill passed in Britain that greatly extended the right to vote in Scotland. And this isn't usually treated. I assume it did that also in England, because by this time the two nations are united. But we're concerned with what happened with regard to the church in Scotland. And so the synod, the Scottish synod, the next year considered what the response ought to be to this new liberty to vote that was extended to many of the people, and they passed an action forbidding to continue the prohibition of voting. So now more of a pressing practical issue, but a continuation of the requirement of political dissent. However, though that decision was made, it was not without controversy, and over a period of 30 years, that prohibition of voting and holding office was abolished in 1863. So 30 years of sort of unease in the church with regard to the practice of political dissent. The Scottish Church in the 1830s drew up a new testimony, which was a replacement for the Act, Declaration, and Testimony of 1761, and was in many points in agreement with the former testimony, but with less of a harsh, negative tone to it. And it was really reflective of a changing attitude and atmosphere, as we might say, in the church. And William Symington had a lot to do with this. During this period, I haven't put it down in the notes, but there were a number of movements in Scotland of an interdenominational or non-denominational character. For example, Bible Society for the translating of the Bible into English and into, not into English at this point, translating the Bible into other languages where foreign missions were going on. And the Covenanters joined with people from other churches in supporting that work. There was a growing temperance movement in Scotland, and the Covenanters joined with others in that. So there were a number of ways in which they began to cooperate with people from other churches. Now, that was different from the strict separation that they had initially adopted under the leadership of Robert Hamilton back at the beginning of the 18th century. So you see a kind of moderation of the original positions that had been taken by the church. I give you a couple of landmarks about size of the church. Let me just do those. At this point, in 1850, there were 46 congregations, 6 presbyteries, 6,900 communicants. Compare that with 1811, when there were three presbyteries and 18 congregations. So there's been significant growth during that period of time. The kind of evangelism and mission work that was being done in Glasgow would be one factor in that growth, and in other places as well as Glasgow. It was then in 1863, when there was a separation, the minority, which is the present Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland, had 9 congregations, 7 ministers, 1,100 members. So only about a fifth of what the church had been just 13 years earlier. By 1915, 7 congregations, 913 communicants. By 2010, 1998 is the last I have the number of members, 3 congregations, less than 150 active members. Presently, 2 congregations and a mission, just a beginning mission effort in Glasgow, meeting in an apartment of one of the members of the Airdrie congregation. So quite a sad decline.
You mentioned in 1863.
I'm going to go back and talk about that now. Yeah. As I said, 1833, they decided to continue political dissent, but with disagreement in the church about that. Come 1863, the issue came up again before their synod, and they recommended to members that they not participate in voting or holding office, but they did not require it. It became a recommendation and not a requirement. And that led to a separation in which the majority of the Reformed Presbyterian Church gave up political dissent. And in 1876, 13 years later, that majority united with the Free Church of Scotland. So after 1876, only the minority of the Reformed Presbyterian Church remained. And that, the majority, even before the Union and after that, rapidly changed their practice. For example, gave up exclusive psalmody. If you've read Peyton's life, you know that he had a portable organ that he used in the New Hebrides for worship and the singing of hymns. So though he grew up in a psalm-singing RP church, he did not continue that when he went to the mission field under the sponsorship eventually of the majority church. Now, last night in talking about the kind of the sad aspect of divisions, I said not all unions were good. And I think that's the case here, because the tragedy is that the Free Church of Scotland, which started out of a commitment to the gospel and strong preaching of the gospel and doctrinal orthodoxy, within a generation had in its seminary those who had embraced higher critical views of the scripture. People like George Adam Smith and A.B. Davidson. And that unbelieving attitude toward the scripture was tolerated. Now, the majority RPs had joined with that group. And as time went on, it became the most liberal of the Presbyterian bodies in Scotland. You might know the name of William Barclay. He's author of very popular commentaries on the Bible. The Daily Study Bible, it's called, a best-selling book, a best-selling set of commentaries, say, in Zondervan bookstores, two evangelicals. But if you read the commentary carefully, and if you read especially William Barclay's own account of his belief, he is simply a modernist. Does not believe in the deity of Christ, is skeptical about the bodily resurrection of Christ, believed in universal salvation, that every single person would ultimately be saved. And William Barclay was a minister of the United Free Church, this church that was formed by the union of the majority of the Covenanters and the Free Church of Scotland. So there's more than one way for a church to die. Sometimes it can dwindle down and be too small to continue. Sometimes it gives up the gospel and becomes, in that sense, a dead church. Joe?
Well, you hear the term Free Church of Scotland today.
Okay. I don't have a chart for Scotland, but I'll do the best I can. It gets a little tricky. There was a further union after 1876 that brought in what was called the United Presbyterian Church. And at that point, a group separated who went by the name the Free Presbyterians. Free Presbyterians, mainly located in the Highlands, very conservative. John Murray at Westminster Seminary came from that group. And they went back to exclusive psalmody, the Free Presbyterians. In 1900, another group separated from the United Free Church, and that is the present day Free Church of Scotland, more orthodox, quite orthodox, psalm singing, until just now. Free Church of Scotland has undergone a recent division, and the majority has now made psalm singing optional. As I've heard, I haven't seen this in writing, up to the individual pastor of a congregation whether they will sing hymns or not. There's another group called the Free Church Continuing that is still a psalm singing church.
So you said that the minority separated. The minority political dissent.
The minority continued to hold the political dissent until 1960, in which they said that discipline for voting was to be held in abeyance. In other words, it's still on the books as something required, but there's a synodical action that says we won't discipline anyone for violation of this position of the church. Well, do you have questions, other questions about the RP Church in Scotland? This is a discouraging thing to think about. The mother church in such a sad condition. But as I said last night, it's not just that church, but there's great decline generally in Christianity in Scotland. The mainline Church of Scotland is like the PCUSA in this country, characterized either by neo-orthodoxy or outright liberalism in the majority of their ministers and congregations. Church attendance, less than 10% of the population. Scotland, if possible, more secular than the United States at the present time. Any other questions or comments?
So would the minority's position be then, in terms of Romans 13, that only would be relevant to a godly leader? So that the authority who's in charge, if they're secular or not godly, then we don't have anything to do with the government. Is that right? I'm trying to get my mind around how they can rationalize not supporting the government or not even paying taxes.
Okay. Well, the position of not paying taxes had disappeared by the time we're talking about. That was the original position that was taken, but that was not continued. And in Scotland, and we'll find a similar pattern both in Ireland and here, there is a long, slow, gradual departure from the position of political dissent. But in the Scottish Testimony of 1837, to go back to that, the position that is taken is this, that, and they're thinking about Romans 13, which you may have in mind as well, which says to pay taxes and to be in submission to the powers that be. Paul writing, when Nero was governor in Rome, to the church in Rome, and so how do they handle that? Well, and I can't give you all the reasons for it, but a distinction was made between nations having the light of the gospel and those that did not. And so they said Romans 13 applies to nations not having the light of the gospel, like Rome, which was a pagan nation, and Christianity is just beginning to come into it. But they're thinking about the fact that the nations of Europe had a history of 1,000 or 1,500 years of having Christianity as the official religion of all of Europe. And now, to depart from that, they regarded as so serious a matter of apostasy that it took away the legitimacy of the government. In part because they regarded it as a violation of the very basis on which the government was founded, like the U.S. Constitution for our country. I mean, if you depart from the founding document, if a government departs from the founding document totally, is it a legitimate government or not? You know, we could face that kind of issue, and that's the way they thought about it. But this distinction between nations having the light of the gospel and not was pretty important. Came also into the U.S. RP testimony as well. Any other questions or comments? Well, that much for the Church of Scotland. Not to leave on a totally discouraging note, Andrew Quigley is pastor in a congregation outside of Glasgow called Airdrie, and it is a active and vital congregation, and they are seeing growth. They have people converted out of really dreadful life situations, coming to Christ and being active in the congregation. It's not a huge congregation, but it is growing. And a number of young people in our church in this country have greatly benefited from going and being at Airdrie and on short-term mission teams and that kind of thing. And so they are seeking to and praying for God to revive the work there and some fruit of that in Airdrie, and we need to keep praying for Airdrie. They're very active, going out, taking literature in neighborhoods around the church and holding series of evangelistic services and that kind of thing. Quite different, I would say, from what has characterized the Scottish congregations in the last couple or three generations. I'd say one other thing as I think about it. Scotland has not produced a minister for the Reformed Presbyterian Church in 100 years. All of their pastors have come from Ireland, or in a couple of cases from the U.S. John Tweed's father was pastor in Glasgow, probably in the 1940s. I'm not sure of the years. John actually went to school in Glasgow. So, but it's a sign of the health of a church whether there are young men growing up who want to go into the ministry, and there had been none from Scotland for 100 years. And in case you're unclear, from this side of the ocean, we often get Scotland and Ireland mixed up. If you're talking to one of them, they want you to be sure that you know they're Scottish and not Irish, and vice versa. And the accent is different, but the Irish church is separately organized, although they work closely together. Okay, let me go on and talk about the church in Ireland then. And the history of the RP Church in Ireland begins with something called the Plantation of Ulster. Ulster is the name that is given to the northern section of the island of Ireland. And the real Irish wouldn't even like us to call it Ireland, I guess, Ire or Erin or something like that. But the northern part is Ulster. In 1607, there was a rebellion of a number of the Catholic Irish nobles against British rule and the rule of King James. And King James sent an army and suppressed the rebellion and confiscated the lands of the Irish lords who had been involved in the rebellion. And then as a means of trying to maintain some kind of control to prevent a further rebellion, James had a kind of homesteading program in which he encouraged Protestants from Scotland and also from England, but primarily from Scotland, to come and settle in Northern Ireland, in Ulster. And many of them did. And therefore, there came to be a group of people known as the Scotch-Irish. And you mustn't think that that means the child of a Scottish father and an Irish mother. That's not the sense of it. The sense is Scottish people who went from Scotland and settled in Ireland. And then from Ireland, from Northern Ireland, many of those people came to this country. And it's not far away. The distance isn't great. There was a lot of interaction back and forth. So that as the society movement, the strict covenanting movement developed in Scotland, there was a corresponding development in the northern counties of Ireland in Ulster. And those folks organized themselves into societies and, in fact, had their own general meeting under the leadership of a covenanter minister by the name of David Houston. When the Scottish Church renewed the covenants in 1712, there were representatives from the Irish societies that were there. Then we skip over quite a number of years. They had no regular ministers, so there were Scottish ministers that would go over from time to time, until in 1760 William Martin was ordained, and then 3 years later William Lynn ordained. And if you have two ministers, in their thinking, you can have a presbytery. So these two, along with elders, organized themselves as the Reformed Presbytery of Ireland. However, that did not last, because both of these ministers went to North America and were involved in the development of the RP Church here in this country. I give the figure there that I read somewhere that in a 2-year period, 30,000 people immigrated from Ulster to America. And that's just in a sample period, but it was a continuing thing. Protestants, I should not say Protestants, those who were not part of the Church of Ireland, which was the established church, were under pretty severe financial and social disabilities because they were not a part of the established church. Difficulties getting married and so on. And Ireland suffered from periodic famines. There was a great potato famine later than this. And so, seeking new opportunity, many Irish immigrated to the United States and became, indeed, the beginnings of the RP Church here. So, when Lynn and Martin came to this country in 1779, the presbytery was disorganized. However, after that time, they had a prominent minister by the name of William Staveley, who held the church together, had a similar position to John Macmillan in Scotland, laboring by himself. A couple of things interesting about him. One is that he got in trouble with the authorities, look there under 1798, arrested on the charge of belonging to the United Irishmen. The United Irishmen was an organization in that time that would correspond to the IRA today, revolutionaries against British rule, made up of Catholics and also some Protestants as well. That's why they were called the United Irishmen. And because, you could understand this, because of the position of political dissent taken by the RP Church, it was easy to suspect them of being a part of this revolutionary movement. And so Staveley was arrested. They thought that he had arms stored in the basement of his church. That was part of the charge that was made against him. But they were unable to prove the charge, and he was released. However, at the same time, there were two young men who were actually executed, who were members of the RP Church, on suspicion of similar revolutionary activity. Adam Lockridge, in his History of the Irish Church, thinks they were not guilty of that, but they were found to be guilty, and they were executed. And that kind of thing was a stimulus for people to leave Ireland, the Covenanters to leave Ireland and come over to this country. I have it here, so maybe I'll take a minute to talk about the Regium Donum. There were seceders in Ireland as well as in Scotland, associate Presbyterians. In 1783, the king offered a special government subsidy to non-conforming churches, that is, churches that were not apart from the Church of Ireland, in gratitude, as he said, for their loyalty. This was regarded by many Irishmen as a bribe, that in order to ensure the loyalty and submission of the nonconformists, the king would give them an annual subsidy that would be of help to them financially. Be careful of government subsidies. There are usually strings attached, and that was the case here. Well, this was not a popular move, and the result of it was that a number of people left the seceders and joined the Covenanters, because the Covenanters were not accepting this government dole. And so it turned out to be to the benefit of the Reformed Presbyterians. In 1811, a synod was organized. I mentioned last night about the same time in Scotland, Ireland, and America. there were enough people to have a synod. There was a minor division in Ireland over political dissent with the formation of a separate group called the Eastern Reformed Presbyterian Synod, which continued on for about 60 years. At the end of that time, a number of their people came back into the RP Church, and the others dispersed to other churches. I'll mention 1857, beginning of work in Australia. This is all part of the British Empire, and Australia was a colony of Britain, and so it was a place where not only prisoners could go, although that was it was a place to get rid of the undesirable criminals, send them to Australia, but others went also for economic opportunity, and so there was a beginning of RP work in Australia in the town of Geelong, I think they say, which continues to the present time, and there is a substantial congregation there. Ed Blackwood is serving in a mission congregation. Church in Australia is quite small. Not flourishing, but it is a distinct denomination now, the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Australia. Some other mission opportunities. The Irish have been involved in foreign mission work. They've cooperated with American missionaries in Latakia, Syria, and other sites in the Near East. In the 1960s, they opened a mission in Ethiopia and continued there until they were forced out by Muslim persecution of the church. And more recently, they've had mission work in France and in Galway, which is in the Republic of Ireland, which is predominantly Catholic. And it's a hard work both in France and in Galway, but they are endeavoring to take the gospel there. I think the other things I'll not talk about, but I'd be glad to answer questions. Well, let me say one thing about statistics. I want you to disregard the last line. I think that 1998 is fairly accurate. 37 congregations, about 6,500 members. I put a question mark with the 2007 figure, and I haven't been able to go back and check that. I think the 1,963 communicants must be wrong, but I'm fairly confident in the 6,500 figure in 1998. The Irish Church is quite a vital church. They are smaller than we in number of congregations, but they tend to have larger congregations than ours. And they are also in a much more limited geographical area, so that the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Ireland is well known in Ireland and is regarded as a kind of peer of other Presbyterian groups there. And is quite influential in that more limited geographical area. When the Irish come over here, they think we're like Ireland and say, well, we'd like to visit Boston and Los Angeles and Orlando, and we have a week, so would you recommend how we do that? And so they're thinking in different geographical terms than we think of. Let me ask if you have questions about the Irish Church.
You had something in your notes here about William Stavely answering Thomas Paine. Did you say that?
I meant to say something about that. This is about the time of the French Revolution. And it's also not long after the American Revolution, and of course we hear a lot these days about Thomas Paine and common sense, the Tea Party people and others going back to the fathers and Thomas Paine. He was influential in political theory and movement, but Thomas Paine was a terrible enemy of the gospel. I don't know if you've ever read Common Sense. I can hardly bear to read it because it's such a vicious attack upon the gospel and upon historic Christianity. He wrote it actually when he was in France, and the mindset of the French Revolution is very much his mindset. So with Stavely being suspected of involvement in revolutionary activity, it's just significant that he was interacting with the intellectual currents of the day and published actually then a response to Thomas Paine, not so much about his political ideas, but about his attack on the gospel. So that's, thank you for reminding me to comment about that. Mary.
Isn't it true now that the Irish Church has a good supply of pastors?
It's varied. It's fluctuated. A few years ago, not so. They had quite a number of vacancies. I think it's better now. And they there have been a number of ministers who have come from other churches into the Irish Church in recent years. Quite able men. So I think they are in better shape than they were for a while. They still have some vacancies, however. I think I mentioned the Theological Hall here. They have a very interesting way of training their ministers. They have a seminary that's called the Reformed Theological College. All of the professors are pastors, and each professor comes in one day a week and teaches in the seminary, and then the rest of the time he's doing his pastoral work. It strikes me that that's a really good way to do theological training, because there's a tendency for theological seminaries to get separated from the real life of the church and become a kind of ivory tower situation. They can do that because of the geographical compactness of the church. So you can commute Ted Donnelly, for example, when he was in Glen Manus, about an hour commute to Belfast to teach in the seminary. So very easy to do that. We're not in a position to do it. We've tried to do that by having, it's not quite a written rule, but it's a pretty firm rule that professors in our seminary must have had pastoral experience. And that's to try to keep the church and the seminary tightly together. And we need to keep praying for Ted Donnelly, who's one of the professors in the seminary, as well as a pastor, and, as you know, is seriously ill with a brain infection. Any other questions? I should say also, now, because I'm trying to skip a few things, 1982, voting in political elections was approved with some qualifications. So they also, the Irish Church also no longer requires political dissent.
What kind of qualifications are they? Do you know what those qualifications are?
I don't now. When I wrote the note, I had just read that, but I don't have it in my mind now. Okay. It's time for us to take a break now. We're ready to move to page 11 and to think about now the history of the church in North America. I need to be careful in talking about this, to use the term North America, because I'm thinking about a son of this congregation who more than once made that point in synod. I'm thinking about my classmate Robert Moore, who was a pastor in Almont, Canada, And we have congregations in Canada, but the majority of our congregations, of course, are in the United States. So in Synod, it's very easy simply to talk about America or the states, and Bob would from time to time stand and say, I want to remind you, this is the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, not of the United States of America. There were Covenanters who came here in the 17th century, or at least tried to come here, but they left no congregation. They did not form congregations, and so they just disappeared into the general population. It is worth noting that in 1685, and that would be at the height of the killing times, remember, there were some Covenanter prisoners that were sent to New Jersey and were involved in founding there a Presbyterian church, not a Covenanter church, but a Presbyterian church that later became known as the Tenant Church. The Tenant brothers were Presbyterian ministers that were involved in the first Great Awakening at the time of Jonathan Edwards. They were closely associated with George Whitefield. And so it's just perhaps a historical curiosity that a church founded in part by Covenanters from Scotland, where they had had significant experience with revival, if you'll remember what we talked about last night, that congregation would be a part of a revival movement in this country. But in the 18th century, people began to come and to actually organize themselves first into societies and then into congregations. And there were five centers of settlement. South Central Pennsylvania, the Susquehanna Valley, the original church or congregation is southeast of the city of Lancaster. We visited there a while ago. There's an old church. I don't know if it's the original building. It has a big sign on it that says, Original Covenanter United Presbyterian Church. And there's a reason for the United Presbyterian, but it's the church where John Cuthbertson preached. And it's quite near Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in the middle of Amish country there. A number of other places, seven societies there, identifiable by 1744. Conococheague Valley was nearby there in south central Pennsylvania. That early, there was another center of settlement in western Pennsylvania, south and east of Pittsburgh, and you folks wouldn't know the names of these creeks, but the Occiagany River and Chartiers Creek, south and east of Pittsburgh. Western Pennsylvania settled largely by Scots-Irish or Scotch-Irish people. Kevin and I were talking about how we should say it. I guess he says the Scottish people want to say Scots-Irish without the CH. So, yeah, okay. Well, the main settlers in western Pennsylvania were Scotch-Irish. In fact, there's a book in our seminary library written by a man by the name of John McMillan, which is a very common name. And he says, this is really not politically correct. He says, when it's not theologically correct either. He says, when the Lord wanted to have western Pennsylvania settled, he knew he needed to have especially strong and courageous race of people to do the settling, because it was on the frontier and Indian country and so on. So he chose the Scotch-Irish. to settle that territory. Not by accident, he himself was Scotch-Irish. So a little bit of ethnic pride going on there. There was settlement in South Carolina, in Chester County, which is in the mountains. You may know about Erskine College and Seminary. Those who founded that were seceders, but they were Scotch-Irish, and that was a center of Scotch-Irish settlement, including Covenanters. Then in New York State, the Hudson Mohawk Valley, our oldest church building in this country is Coldenham. It's on the Hudson River, near the Hudson River, near Newburgh in New York, and further up where the Mohawk meets the Hudson, around the vicinity of Albany. When we talk about rivers, in the early days without roads, often the courses of rivers were how people traveled, either along the bank of the river or sometimes by boat if it was big enough. And I've wondered about, number five is the Connecticut River Valley. We have a couple of, they're not there any longer, but old congregations up in Barnet and Reigate, which is in northern Vermont, fairly close to the Canadian border. I wondered how those people got there. They could have come up the St. Lawrence River, but in fact, I think they went up the Connecticut River, which goes clear up into that territory.
Greg? There is a each year there is a psalm sing in one of, I don't know if it's those locations.
There is still a Barnett church building. Ken Smith, whom you may know, lived in Barnet when he was a young boy. His father, A.W. Smith, was pastor there. And I think in order to keep the building in the possession of whoever owns it, they have to have a service once a year, so they have a psalm sing in the Barnet Church, in a beautiful part of Vermont. So these are the areas of geographical settlement. And in one sense, it's not a very spiritual thing, but in God's providence, under the mediatorial kingship of Christ, patterns of settlement and immigration have affected the health and the growth of the church. And for the church in this country, you can trace patterns of settlement starting with the East Coast cities. There were at one time six congregations in New York City. There were three in Philadelphia. There were four, I believe, in Boston, congregation in Baltimore. So as the people came from Scotland and especially from Ireland, they landed first in those coastal cities. There would be Scotch or Irish people already there. Then maybe themselves or the next generation would move on west. And so you had settlements in Iowa and Illinois, and then from then on into Kansas, and then Colorado. And then the West Coast congregations were begun by people who had moved there from often from Kansas. So a pattern of immigration and moving westward, and in a sense, the church followed the pioneers who were moving west. That was the pattern of settlement. Now, at some point, I'll talk about that. Maybe I'll do it now, and if it's in the notes, I'll not do it later. In the 1870s, there was a man appointed to go and travel through the Northwest, Oregon and Washington, to see if there were any settlements of Covenanters in that area, with the idea, if there were, then we should do home mission work there. And the committee, the minister who was appointed to do that, came back and said, I didn't find any significant Covenanter settlements. And then he said, this is quite significant, if we want to gather in the straggled remnants of covenanters, then this is not a field for us. In other words, people who are already RPs, who had moved west without asking, will we have a good church? You know, they just moved west for economic reasons. If that's our strategy for home missions, then it's not a field for us. If we want to find the people who are lost, who need the gospel, there's a great field there. But the church decided not to go there until some settlers went to Portland, some covenanters went to Portland and to Seattle, and then we had congregations there. So in terms of strategy, the church has tended to follow the patterns of immigration and has thought initially about ministry to our own people, not to exclude reaching out to others, but as the core of interest. Let's not have these people lost to the church. Let's conserve them for the church by sending ministers to be there. Well, I've skipped a Roman numeral. Excuse me for that. I'll talk about the first RP ministers. One was with us for a relatively short time, a man by the name of Alexander Craighead, who came over from Ireland, who was a friend of the Tennant brothers and of George Whitfield, and was, as I say here, pro-revival and pro-subscription. Why do I say that? Well, about in connection with the Great Awakening, there was a division among Presbyterians. Some of them were very skeptical about the whole revival experience. And instead, they were concerned with doctrinal soundness and purity. They thought those involved in the revivals were not concerned about sound doctrine. So they were called pro-subscription. They were in favor of a strict subscription to the Westminster Confession of Faith and to Calvinistic doctrine. So you get an opposition between those who are in favor of revival and those who are in favor of sound Calvinistic doctrine. And that came to be known in Presbyterian circles as the old school pro-subscription versus the new school, more concerned about outreach and evangelism and revival. And those two put in kind of opposition to one another, which they ought not to be. But that was the split. So sometimes people will ask me who come from those circles, is the RP church old school or new school? And the answer is yes. Concerned about sound doctrine, also open to revivals and to other similar things taking place in the Christian world around. Well, Craighead, then pro-revival, pro-subscription. He ministered to scattered societies between 1742 and 1750. He led in a covenant renewal service at Middle Octorara, Pennsylvania in 1743. That's close to Lancaster, this original congregation. It's the place where John Cuthbertson settled. He then moved south to Virginia, ultimately ended up in North Carolina, and there was believed to be responsible for something called the Mecklenburg Declaration. I don't know if you may have heard of this. I heard Billy Graham talk about it once in a sermon, and the story is this, that when Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, this is the way Billy Graham talked about it, he had on his desk a copy of the Mecklenburg Declaration, which had been written under covenanter influence in South Carolina. where Craighead was. Well, this is dated 1775, the year before the Declaration of Independence, and it's a statement adopted by the people of Mecklenburg County, South Carolina, and here's what they say. Resolved that we, the citizens of Mecklenburg County, do hereby dissolve the political bands which have connected us to the mother country, and hereby absolve ourselves from all allegiance to the British Crown, and abjure all political connection, contract, or association with that nation, who have wantonly trampled on our rights and liberties, and inhumanly shed the innocent blood of American patriots at Lexington. So this is after the Battle of Lexington and Concord. That would be a feather in our cap, in a sense, if this is true, that we had, Covenanters had some responsibility for the Declaration of Independence. However, it is historically questionable. The first time this document appeared was in a newspaper in 1819, and there's no earlier copy than that. David Carson talks about it in Transplanted to America, and he's a historian. He says the evidence seems to be against the genuineness of this document. So if you use it, you ought to be careful about it and say it's not sure, it's not for sure that this took place. But it would fit in with the views of the Covenanters and of a man like Alexander Craighead to declare non-allegiance to the British Crown and to the British country. Well, by the time he had gone to North Carolina, he was no longer connected with Reformed Presbyterians, and so he didn't stay with our people. The next minister was John Cuthbertson. He's from Scotland, not Ireland, ordained by the Reformed Presbytery in Scotland, and soon thereafter came and settled there in Pennsylvania. It's an interesting thing to think about that the Irish and the Scottish churches both, when they had very few ministers, the ones they did ordain, a good proportion of them came to North America. And that was to the loss of the home church. We've just been involved, you might think about this. We pray sometimes the Shawnee will daughter a congregation. I don't know if you're praying for that or not. We need to be realistic. Church planting often involves a loss to the mother church. And when our group left North Hills with their blessing, it was a hard year after that for North Hills, a loss of some of their most active members and most generous contributors, and so a hard time afterwards. So we ought not to be romantic about church planting. It's hard work, both on the part of those who do the planting and those who send them out to do the planting. So if we pray for that, if you pray for that, be careful what you pray for. It's not going to be all easy. Cuthbertson was for sure a circuit rider. And he traveled on horseback, mind you. This is in the 1700s. All over these scattered settlements of Covenanters up into New England, out to western Pennsylvania. I don't think he went down to the Carolinas, but he traveled thousands of miles on horseback. And while he traveled, he kept a journal. And that journal has become a treasure trove for people who are into genealogy, because he would record in his journal whose house he stayed at, He would record what texts he preached from in on the Sabbath. He would baptize children and write their names down and the names of their parents. So it's a treasure trove for genealogy. But one of David Carson comments, one of the most frequent entries in the journal is tired, very tired. So think of traveling by horseback with no roads or primitive paths and traveling all over to minister to these scattered covenanters. When the union with the seceders came in 1782, I'll talk about that in a minute, Cuthbertson entered into that union, and so he ended his life as a part of the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, the ARP. Well, the presbytery was formed in 1772 because Matthew Lynn, we talked about him earlier as having been ordained in Ireland, and another man, I believe from Scotland, Alexander Dobbin. No, they're both sent by the Irish presbytery. I'm unsure about that. He may have originally been from Scotland. But they came over from Ireland in 1772 and joined with Cuthbertson to organize a presbytery at a place called Paxtang, which I found is now a part of the city of Harrisburg in Pennsylvania, the capital of Pennsylvania. And Alexander Dobbin's house is now a museum in Gettysburg open to the public. So if you make a trip there, you might want to see the home of one of the early covenanter ministers in this country. Another man, William Martin, came from Ireland to South Carolina 1772, but was suspended from the ministry for intemperance, and he was not the only one, the only minister. And we'll talk later about the deep involvement of the RP Church in the temperance movement, which was a very broad movement, sweeping especially the northern part of the United States. And part of the motivation behind that was the frequent trouble with drunkenness on the part of ministers in the church. And part of it was a social convention. Let me talk about that a minute. I was, my time in Romania, stayed in the home of a pastor on Sabbath night after services were over for a special treat for his American guests. He brought out a bottle of brandy that he himself had distilled. This was the highest courtesy he could show to his visitors. And though the others who were with me were not from our church partook of that, and I politely declined, was helped in that because his wife also declined, and so she was kind of comforted me in that. But that was courtesy. Well, you're a pastor, you go to visit people, and make a number of calls on an afternoon, they're going to show courtesy by bringing out the special treat of the bottle that they have. And so there was a special temptation for pastors especially. And I'm not saying that was the reason, I'm just saying that sad experience, personal for the ministers involved and for their congregations, made the church very open to this temperance movement that was developing. Well, in 1782, after the American Revolution, the seceders and the covenanters began discussing union. There was a similar pattern of immigration by the seceders from Ireland and from Scotland, and so they were a sizable group in this country, a bigger group than the covenanters. And the thing that had separated them in Britain had been the question about relationship to the civil government. And the seceders had not held off from participation in the government the Covenanters had. Now, after the revolution, they're under a different government. They're not under a covenant-breaking government. They don't have all the background of the history that we have talked about. And so for a majority, or about half, I guess is a more accurate way of saying it, of the Covenanters, they didn't see that they were still obligated to maintain a position of separation, of dissent from the government. And so the union took place 1782 on the seceder basis, that is, accepting the seceder view of civil government rather than the covenanter view about civil government. And so the church was significantly diminished because the three ministers who had formed the presbytery became a part of the united church, and so those who did not enter into the union were left again without any ministers, and continued that way until 17, for about 10 years, and then there wasn't a presbytery again until 1798. A couple of ministers came over, a couple of more ministers came over to Carolina for Ireland, appointed to be a committee of the Irish Church to organize a work in the Carolinas. But McGarrah, one of them, was suspended for drunkenness, and the other died. And so that was virtually the end of the work in the Carolinas, especially when the church adopted a position against slavery. People from the Carolinas, some of them freed their slaves, but were frowned upon by people around them who were still slaveholders. And so they, a number of them, moved up to southern Illinois and became part of the church there around Sparta and Oakdale. And if you have occasion to talk to James Ferris, that's his history, the history of his family. And he and his wife on a vacation went down and looked up old records down in the Carolinas where the Ferris family had originally lived.
Are there any records of the particulars of that slaveholding? I know the seminary has done some more things in the last few years. Are there particulars of how many were in that body, how many released their
slaves? In Carolinas? That's a question for James Ferris. I don't have an answer to it. I'm sure James knows, if anyone in our church does. Well, in 1793, James McKinney came over from Ireland and settled near Albany, New York. William Gibson, who was his brother-in-law, came over from Ireland 4 years later and settled in Philadelphia. And on a visit to Philadelphia on the part of McKinney, the two of them formed a presbytery. You have two ministers, you can have a presbytery. Now, let me comment on that. It might be of interest to you. You may know that our missionaries in the Sudan have just organized a church there with elders. And question was raised in synod about whether this was done in a regular way. That is, these men are not seminary graduates, for example. And so was this a regular ordination? And a couple of members of the foreign mission of the Board of Global Missions came to me and said, ask me, isn't it true that the original organization of our church in this country was an irregular organization? That is to say, McKinney and Gibson had not been authorized either by the Irish Presbytery or by the Scottish Presbytery to take this action. They did it on their own. And yet what they had organized came to be recognized after the fact by the Scottish and the Irish churches, and then we had fraternal relations. And I don't want to make a big deal about that, but often in a mission situation, in fact, it's in our book of government, in a mission situation, the usual procedures aren't always appropriate. And our missionaries in Sudan who face, depending on the outcome this coming Lord's Day of the referendum there, the real prospect of not being able to go back. And they wanted to have something in place that could keep the work going there, even though it might not in all ways fit the pattern of the way we do things in our situation. So we count 1798 as the date for the formal organization of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America. And there was a 200th anniversary commemoration of this in 1998 in Beaver Falls. And we had a number of papers that were presented. They were supposed to be published, but it's never taken place. And they exist somewhere, but I don't know now how to find them. Well, then some further organizational developments on the next page. Partly because of difficulty of travel, the presbytery, which had been organized in 1798, formed three committees designated not very creatively: Northern, Middle, and Southern. Southern would be the Carolinas, though that soon disappeared. But Northern and Middle Presbyteries and, I'm sorry, committees of the Presbytery. And under that organization, the American Church approved a testimony and new terms of communion. And that was published in a book that looks like this, and the title is Reformation Principles Exhibited. As time went on, we came simply to call it the Reformed Presbyterian Testimony, but originally Reformation Principles Exhibited. It had quite a long historical section in which it traced the history of the church, and then at the end has a doctrinal statement called the Declaration and Testimony, which parallels the Westminster Confession. And this is a bit of a puzzle for me as I think about it. They had been strongly committed to the Westminster Confession. They were bound to it, in fact, by covenant, and had suffered for that adherence. But, and this had happened in Scotland and Ireland as well, instead of simply saying, this is our doctrinal statement, and we will supplement it, perhaps, here and there. All three churches drew up a document that was really a parallel to the Westminster Confession. And the church itself did not publish the Westminster Confession nor the other documents. They were readily available from other churches. But we did publish our own testimony, and the effect of that was it gave a greater prominence to the testimony than it did to the Westminster Confession. Now, there wasn't a huge difference between the two. I'm not saying this was a really bad thing to do. It's a little puzzling to me that when they already had a confession to which they were committed, that they would restate it, in a sense. That's really what it is. But they did that. And so it parallels the Westminster Confession with the addition of a number of other chapters dealing with topics not covered in the Westminster Confession. And so let me make a brief comment about some of these additions. They added chapter 4, a chapter on human reason. Well, think about that a little bit. We spoke about Thomas Paine, He was supposed to have belonged to what was called the Age of Reason. This is after what is called the Enlightenment, so there were all kinds of intellectual debates, both outside the Christian church and within it, about the proper role of reason. That hadn't been an issue in the same way in the 1640s when the Westminster Confession was written. And so I'll just give you one statement from this to give you a sense of it. And the fourth section says, "The veracity of God and not the reasonableness of any doctrine is the ground of our faith." The veracity of God and not the reasonableness of any doctrine. Now, they say also in the chapter, it's not that Christian doctrines are not reasonable, but that's not the ground of faith, is the position that they take. And when they talk about the veracity, the truthfulness of God, they mean by that God is the ultimate author of the Bible. And because God is truth and speaks only the truth, as the Westminster Confession says, therefore that it is said in the Word is the ground of our faith, because that's God's Word to us. I will mention probably more than once my reading of the life of Charles Hodge, and I don't fully agree with his view about the role of human reason, but for him also the Scripture was the ultimate ground of faith. And he was asked one time about a woman who had said that she believed that literally the whale had, she was asked if she could believe that the whale had swallowed Jonah. And her reply was, "If the Scripture said Jonah had swallowed the whale, I would believe it." And Charles Hodge said, "I agree with her." He quoted that favorably. The ground of faith is that it is in the Bible. Then you work out the problems with relation to reason. Well, there's a chapter on the Holy Spirit. There is not a separate chapter on the Holy Spirit in the Confession. And other Presbyterians have also added a chapter on the Holy Spirit. This is very brief, but it really wants to underline the Holy Spirit, that the Holy Spirit is one of the three persons of the Godhead, equal to the Father and the Son in glory, and also is a person and not an impersonal power. There's a chapter on Christ's headship. You know, we're not a liturgical church, but in our session and presbytery and the synod meetings, we have formulas of words that we use regularly. So we constitute the court and we adjourn the court in the name and by the authority of the Lord Jesus Christ, Zion's only King and Head. Now you'll have a sense of the meaning of that when you review in your mind what we've been over with the struggle against a king who said, "I am the head on earth of the church. I speak for Christ. And what I say you must do, Zion's only King and Head." So it's not surprising there's a chapter on the headship of Christ. Chapter 20. Well, I've skipped over the gospel offer, but I'll come back to that in a moment. I wanted to read section 2. Christ, the God-man, laid the foundation of the church's existence and salvation in his own infinite righteousness. He quickens church members by his divine spirit. He lives in them and they in him as their life and strength. That's union with Christ, very central to Reformed doctrine. And he alone has a right to appoint ordinances and officers and to establish laws as the king and head of his church. And then it goes on to say, submission is due to the mediatory authority from all the intelligent creatures of God. Men, not only as saints and church members, but also in every possible relation and condition, are under obligation to subserve his gracious purposes according to his law. In every possible relation and condition. That means as the citizen of a nation, or in forming a government, the Christian is under obligation to obey Christ and his law. And so this points then to the issue about the need for the government to submit to Christ and Christians to be concerned about that. Let me go back to the gospel offer. There had been a debate in, really, that was involved in the secession, the seceders leaving the Church of Scotland, over a book called The Marrow of Modern Divinity, and it had to do in part with how you preach the gospel to sinners. And the doctrine of the marrow was that the gospel must be urgently preached to sinners, and they should be called immediately and without delay to respond to the gospel. Now, there were lukewarm folks in the Church of Scotland and didn't like that fervent evangelical doctrine. And they clothed their objection to it in theology. And they said, Calvinistic doctrine teaches that Christ died only for the elect, and it follows then that we can offer the gospel only to the elect. How would you know who is elect? Well, they said, we must see evidence that the Holy Spirit is working in that person by bringing them under deep conviction of sin and sorrow for sin, and that would be evidence that they are elect. And then, if we see that evidence, we can say to such persons, you should receive Christ as your Savior. It's called, in general terms, preparationism. There has to be some previous work and evidence of that work before the gospel can be freely offered to sinners. And so the seceders and the covenanters believed in the universal offer to the gospel, what's called the free offer of the gospel. And they say this in section 4, preaching the gospel does not consist in promising salvation to all who hear it, or in affirming that Christ has redeemed each of them, but in a free and full offer of a Savior to every individual, declaring that he who believes shall be saved, and he who believes not shall be damned. There is no inconsistency between the doctrine of particular redemption and unlimited gospel offer. Now, this may seem like kind of a technical theological point, and I guess it is, but the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, when they were first organized, had a controversy about this, about the free offer of the gospel. And R.B. Kuyper, who taught in Westminster Seminary, wrote a book about it. And the OP Church came down on the side of the free offer of the gospel. You may know of the Protestant Reformed Church, a Dutch church which separated from the Christian Reformed, over this issue. And the Protestant Reformed Church does not believe in this free offer of the gospel in this sense. There must be some evidence of election before you can offer Christ to someone. Well, a chapter on church government, Presbyterianism, because that's not included in the Westminster Confession. It's in another document of the assembly, but not in the confession. Then two chapters on civil government, chapter 28 on civil government and 29 on the right of dissent. And later, the numbering of those got changed, but in the original edition, that was the numbering. I'll just comment about civil government. It's clear that it was based upon what we call the social compact theory of government, that people existed in a state of nature which with each person possessing natural rights, and then at some point they decide for the mutual good to join together in a voluntary association and to delegate to the government certain powers to be carried out for the common good. And in the political debates that are taking place now, you will hear echoes of that kind of debate. Where does the federal government get its power? And the conservatives will say, well, it's delegated to them from the states. Where do the states get their power? In this theory, it has been given to them by the people who join together to form the political body or the voluntary association. And later on, in a revision of this chapter, the church abandoned the view of social compact to another view, which I don't find it very easy to describe, so I'll not try. Chapter 29 on the right to dissent. So this is to maintain that position of dissent from the government that we've talked about. And then, interestingly to me, the final chapter is called Testimony Bearing. And it has the idea that the church will produce a testimony. And they're thinking about testimony in this sense. Act, declaration, and testimony. A written testimony from the church officially, which sets forth the truth and defends it against all errors that arise from time to time. And here's part of what they say about this. The testimony of the church is progressive in order to oppose and condemn the novel errors which each period may produce. And every generation is to take care that the truth, as stated and defended by their predecessors, shall be maintained and faithfully transmitted together with the result of their own contendings to the succeeding generation. So they're thinking about a cumulative testimony being added to as each generation contends against error. And then they say at the end, the witnesses must proceed in finishing their testimony, rendering it more pointed and complete until God shall, according to his promise, overthrow the empire of darkness and introduce the millennial state in which the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. I talked yesterday about the post-millennialism of the church. And so it's a kind of daunting thing if you think about they had a book of this size and the idea is going to keep being added to on and on in each generation. Think about that happening for 1,000 years. You'd have a pretty big book. Well, they didn't think the world was going to last 1,000 years. I shouldn't have chosen that particular figure. They didn't think it was going to last generation after generation. They believed that the time of the inauguration of the millennium was near. I mentioned 1866. Alexander MacLeod was the principal author of this testimony. He wrote the book that said, Revelation says it's going to begin in 1866. So they were thinking of a couple of more generations to add to the testimony. Then the testimony would be complete and the millennium would come. So let me give you an opportunity for questions and then we'll take a break. About when to bring this in, but I think it may be time to do it now, and you may it may come up again. But if you could find this diagram that was at the end of your notes, let me try to catch you up to speed on that. This is a chart put out by the OP Church. You'll notice that Orthodox Presbyterian Church is in the boldest and biggest font. Which is quite understandable. It doesn't reflect the size of the church, say, in comparison to the PCUSA, but it's, of course, it's quite legitimate. It's their chart, so they wanted to highlight their denomination. So the upper half of the chart has to do with mainline Presbyterian history. And at some point, if you have questions, I'll try to answer them, though you see it's a pretty complicated diagram. But the bottom has to do with our history. And so you have the Reformed Presbytery organized in 1774, the Associate Presbytery earlier than that, 1753, those two combining in 1782. So now we have talked about that. And they formed what was called the Associate Reformed Synod. Later, I don't know for what reason, they added the word Presbyterian. It was known that they were Presbyterian. And so they, just above that, Associate Reformed Presbytery of the South, or Presbyterian Church of the South. Initially, they were a part of the whole group, but for geographical reasons, and I think cultural reasons, not doctrinal disagreement, they became separate. Hard to travel back and forth in those days, and a cultural difference between the South and the North. So they just had a separate existence without a special split or controversy. Then there were some seceders who did not enter into that union, and they were called the Associate Synod of North America. In 1858, the ARP and the Associate Synod united to form the United Presbyterian Church of North America. And until recent times when we said UP Church, that's the group that we meant. When they were formed, they agreed with the Covenanters in everything, and I mean everything, except political dissent. They were psalm singing without instruments. They believed in continuing obligations of the covenants. They did not allow their members to be part of secret societies. They practiced close communion. Originally, they were like us in every respect. They even had a doctrine, the mediatorial kingship of Christ, in their testimony. But they did not have political dissent, so they differed from us only in that. There were some who stayed out of that union, and they continued as the Associate Synod dwindled down until in 1969 they united with our church. That's Mineola, Washington, Iowa, Reimersburg, Pennsylvania, Tuska in Pennsylvania, four congregations united with us. It looks as though the RPs went out of existence in 1782, according to the chart. They did, in terms of organization, although the societies continued, reorganized. And there's a typo there. It should be 1798, not 1793. the Reformed Presbytery. Then we'll talk in a little bit about the division of 1833 to form Old Light Synod, that's us, and New Light Synod or General Synod. And that's where we are up till now. Maybe I'll not talk more about it until we come to more recent developments, but I will give opportunity for questions if you want to ask.
Old Light Synod Reformed Presbyterian, that's us.
That's RPCNA. And there had been a formation before the split. And again, think of difficulty of travel. I think we talked last night. Elders from Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, near Pittsburgh, walked on foot to Philadelphia to attend synod. So great difficulty in travel. So they tried for a while to have what they called subordinate synods, meeting every year, and then on every 2 years, a general synod. Well, that was the situation in 1833, and so those who split from us kept the name General Synod. But the nickname was always, we are the Old Light Covenanters, they are the New Light Covenanters. And so, in terms of terminology. Yes, Mary Lou.
Do you have the North and the South? I know I'm not sure that you're part of the South, but the two name church you were saying. Is there a...
Yeah. This is where it gets complicated. Let's see. After the Civil War, without going into divisions and reunions, after the Civil War, the mainline Presbyterian Church in the North was PCUSA, Presbyterian Church in the United States of America. The church in the South was called the Presbyterian Church in the U.S., PCUS. And as you can see, let's see if you can see. No. Yes, it's complicated. Northern and Southern churches united in 1983. From 1958 until 1983, UPUSA meant the combined Northern Presbyterian Church and the UP Church. What folks say is all that the UP Church got out of the union was the name. So they were called United Presbyterian Church in the USA. After the union with the Southern Church, they took the name of the Well, they went back just to being the Presbyterian Church USA. So, mainline church is now PCUSA, no longer a northern and southern division. It's interesting to think about that in terms of the general church scene. You may have been aware there was about the 1950s a great movement to unite churches. The ecumenical movement, a great interest in that and agitation for it, which resulted in a number of unions and the denominations that came from the unions all put United in their name. So today we have a United Methodist Church, which was made up of a union between Methodists and, if I can get this right, Evangelical United Brethren, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? And you have a United Church of Christ, which is the old Congregational Church, which joined with a denomination called Evangelical and Reformed. And that's another story about the history of that church. It was Reformed and Lutheran. But it's, and the ecumenical movement has died, in the sense of there are no more huge corporate mergers of the major denominations. So it's just, it was a great issue at the time, and it has virtually disappeared. And so United Presbyterian Church was a part of that general movement. Okay. In 1809, the church went from a presbytery to a synod. Again, quite small, 7 ministers, 3 presbyteries. There were probably other ministers who couldn't make it because of difficulty of travel. But our synod goes back then to 1809. We're 201 years old as a synod. I've talked about the organizational arrangement to have a general synod, which would meet only biennially, and then be delegated. That is, not every minister would attend, but delegates would be decided by the presbyteries. It didn't work out long term, but that happened for a while. It was a factor in the division over political dissent that took place in 1833. I'll talk about that in a minute. The General Synod, that's the New Light Church, at a couple of years after the split, had 12 ministers. A year later, the RPCNA had 17 ministers. We were slightly larger. I think the division in membership was about 50-50. So you had 2 Reformed Presbyterian Church of about the same size. And in subsequent years, and I don't know the ups and downs of it, but certainly in the 20th century, the New Light Church, the General Synod Church, declined more sharply than our church did until they finally entered into a union with the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, when they had less than 2,000 members. And some of their larger congregations had recently come into the denomination. We declined. I'm not denying that fact, but they declined more rapidly than we did. Well, how did the split come about? Well, to finish that, withdrawal of the Steelites. The technical point that led David Steele and others to leave the church in 1840 was whether members of the Covenanter Church could join other voluntary associations for Christian or moral purposes. Specifically, at issue was joining an organization called the American Colonization Society, which was formed, and Alexander MacLeod was one of the leaders in it, to send freed slaves to Africa to form the country of Liberia. Do you know the name of the capital of Liberia? It is Monrovia, named for President James Monroe. So there was a thought that it would be better to allow freed slaves to return to Africa. It later turned out, by the way, that that organization was liberally financed by slaveholders because they thought that the presence of freed slaves would create unrest among those who were still in slavery. And so, while early the RP Church had supported the American Colonization Society, later we repudiated it and withdrew our support. But David Steele, for a different reason, objected to that, because he said, we who are in covenant together must not join together for any reason with those who are uncovenanted. And the general stance of David Steele and the Steelites was to maintain the kind of strict separation that Robert Hamilton had originally proposed after the Revolution Settlement of 1689. And so the Steelites were a fiercely separatist group. who regarded us as perhaps the most unfaithful of all the churches because of the history that we had, the common history that we had had with them. Steelites were never a large movement. I think at the most, maybe 10 small congregations and less ministers, fewer ministers than that. I preached for 25 years for the last existing Steelite congregation near us in western Pennsylvania. The folks there, there were only a handful of them. I preached on Sabbath afternoon so I could be at our own services. They'd forgotten most of their heritage. They were pretty much just traditional people, and there were less than 10 elderly people who attended the services. So it was never a movement that flourished. And I should say, however, it still exists on the internet, and I think has some influence. People see what's on the internet; they're attracted to it. There aren't any real congregations, except perhaps one in Edmonton, Alberta. That's newly a part of the group, and from 25 years' experience, it's not a place where the Lord is working with vigor, and my preaching, I have to say, didn't change that. So I want to acknowledge that. So that's a word about the Steelites. The danger that I see on the web, I'll say this, I know it's being recorded, is that people are attracted to a movement that cannot provide them with real congregational life and pastoral care. So they leave living congregations to join something that has its existence mainly on the internet. And I regard it as a harmful thing, and that's why I mention it. I'll talk about 1891 later. Now, political dissent. The maintenance of political dissent was the reason that those covenanters, that meant that some covenanters stayed out of the Union of 1782. By the way, John Cuthbertson, who went into the Union, later expressed some regret at the way things were going, and said maybe the Lord will again revive the covenanting cause. So he wasn't entirely satisfied with what was happening in the ARP. In 1806, S.B. Wiley, who became the first professor of the Theological Seminary in the city of Philadelphia, wrote an influential booklet, a small book called The Two Sons of Oil. It's a curious title. It refers to the prophecy of Zechariah, where you remember there is an olive tree and there are two branches from which oil flows, and they represent Joshua and Zerubbabel, the priest, and the civil magistrate. So he used that as kind of a symbol of church and state. And the idea was both are under the mediatorial kingship of Christ. And in that book, S.B. Wiley gave a defense of political dissent, and David Carson gives it page 18, and his reasons for dissent, which Carson summarizes in 5 points, are these. First, the federal constitution does not recognize the existence of God. Secondly, the Constitution, both state and federal, constitutions plural, establish a toleration of religion which recognizes heresy on an equal footing with truth. Now, this is following on in the views held in Scotland early on that the government ought to see that only the true church functions and does not allow those who depart from the truth to function. There's This is not the, there is a criticism of the Constitution for its toleration of religious differences. Third, there is no provision for the interest of true religion, no financial support. For example, for the true church and other ways, the government does not come to the support of the true church, is what they mean when they say true religion. Fourth, there is no religious test for office holders. Wiley thought that they must at least be Protestant Christians. The Constitution should limit office holding to Protestants. And finally, the recognition of the principle of slavery. This coming early on, as you notice, objection to the Constitution's recognition of slavery. It's a kind of hidden recognition in the Constitution. It appears in the directions for membership in the House of Representatives, in which a slave counts less than a free man in reckoning the population. I think it's 3/5 of a man. I'm not remembering exactly the proportion. But, House of Representatives is made up of districts that are according to population. That's why we have a census. And when the South took a census, slaves counted less than free people. And so that's a tacit recognition in the Constitution of slavery. And that was one of the objections of our church to the Constitution.
There was debate among the members of Congress today, for the first time ever in history, I guess, in session, the United States Constitution was read at the U.S. House of Representatives. And part of the debate was, which, you know, were they going to read the original Constitution or the Constitution as amended?
Uh-huh.
And the amendment group won out in part because they didn't want to have to read that to the 3/5.
Yeah. Well, I knew they were going to do that. Technically, and I think this is true because of developments in our church, the original wording was not changed, but it was superseded by something in an amendment. So, David Carson says this was the first comprehensive statement of an American principle of dissent as distinct from the position of the Scottish and Irish Covenanters. They're dealing now with a new government and a new constitution, and so dissent takes on a different basis. I'm mentioning that to underline the importance of political dissent for the church. I've already mentioned that in the testimony, which was adopted in 1807, there were chapters. I've given here the later numbering of them on civil government and on the right of dissent, which continued to be a part of the testimony of the church. In 1812, think of that date now, not the 1812 overture, but the War of 1812. Alexander McLeod was a pastor in New York City, one of the leading pastors in New York City. He was a peer with the Presbyterians and Episcopalians and others in terms of prominence and influence. In the War of 1812, there are British ships in the New York harbor threatening, if not actually bombarding, the city. And in that circumstance, the Covenanters are under deep suspicion because they are, most of them, immigrants who have not been naturalized. That would involve an oath to the Constitution. And so they are British subjects and are suspected of being a kind of underground who would be likely to support the British. So Alexander McLeod and his church preached a series of sermons on the subject. And the thrust of the sermons was this: the United States Constitution is defective and we cannot support it, but the British Constitution and the British government even more so. And therefore, it is right for Covenanters to pray for the victory of the United States in its war with Great Britain. So, still a position of dissent, but I think significantly the beginnings of what I see as a long-term development of a growing appreciation for and loyalty to the United States government, in spite of the objections to the Constitution. Harold brought me a book that he found that we published after the First World War called Soldiers of the Church. It's a whole book, which is a record of all of those who served in the military services and in the hospital corps and so on in defense of the country or in fighting in World War I in Europe. And it's an expression of patriotism and of the loyalty of the church to the country while maintaining a position of dissent. And as I look over the whole history of this, there is a growing tension because of this. The church is moving away from the strict separation from the government and condemnation of it, which had characterized its early life. There's a growing appreciation for it. And in gradual steps, there's more and more involvement. Time comes with the Civil War. I'll talk about it now to illustrate. The Covenanters strongly believe the Civil War was fought about slavery. There's debate about that today, but that was their understanding of the war. It was a war to abolish slavery. And they were strongly abolitionist. And so many of the young men of the church enlisted to fight in the Civil War on the side of the North, including a pastor by the name of A.C. Todd, who took a whole regiment from his congregation to fight in the Civil War. When they did that, it was contrary to the law and order of the church because they were sent a letter from Scotland that said, how much more could you do to support and defend the Constitution than to bear arms in its defense? And so after the war was over, the church said, well, you oughtn't to have done that, but they didn't exercise discipline upon those who had fought in the war. In fact, D.B. Wilson became a professor in the seminary, and in addition to being a minister, he'd been a medical doctor, and he served as a military surgeon in the Civil War, later was elected to teach in the seminary. A.C. Todd. Colorado, I believe, but that's not in my memory at this moment.
Sparta.
Okay, thank you. Sparta. Did he later go to Colorado? Do you know? Okay. Well, I know his name, and he fought in the war, so. Well, continuing then to, we'll come now to the split of 1833. I jumped ahead to talk about Civil War. I don't know why this was done. I expect it was because there was discussion and agitation within the church. But in 1832, the Eastern Subordinate Synod, you had the General Synod under it, two subordinate synods. The Eastern Subordinate Synod drafted a pastoral letter. It was, in fact, written by S.B. Wiley, who had done the Two Sons of Oil, to address the matter of relationship to the government. And the draft of this pastoral address included a statement which questioned political dissent. David Carson gives it on page 28. This pastoral address included statements. I'm trying to put my eye on it on 28. Maybe some of you will see it before me. It's in the third column, about two-thirds of the way down, what David Carson calls the offending paragraphs. He agreed that the principle of the church was that no institution whatever shall be by any act of ours homologated, that's a term meaning we'll not profess allegiance or swear allegiance to it, the recognition of which shall, by the decision of the local judicatories, involve immorality. But, he said, the government of the United States does not fall in that category. It is susceptible of demonstration, says Wiley, that since the commencement of Christianity, no government on earth has had a fairer claim to recognition as the ordinance of God than that of these United States. Their position had been the government is illegitimate. Now, Wiley is saying he's come 180 degrees from Two Sons of Oil, and he says if any government ever deserved to be recognized as legitimate, it is the United States government. Well, the Eastern Subordinate Synod passed an action that this pastoral address should be circulated to the congregations with these statements deleted. In other words, the questioning of dissent taken out of the pastoral address before it was circulated. However, Wiley published it with the paragraphs, with the statement against, which was ultimately against dissent. In response to that, there was a special meeting of the Subordinate Synod called in the fall. It was called a Pro Re Nata meeting. That came to be the way it was talked about. That's language that means a specially called meeting. And then you have to, the first action is to have a vote that approves of the calling of the special meeting. So the main point is a special meeting. And that special meeting of the Subordinate Synod suspended McLeod, Wiley, and a number of others who had supported this, and then referred their case to the next meeting of the General Synod. It happened that the clerk of the General Synod was John McLeod, who was a son of Alexander McLeod, and was sympathetic to Wiley and to those who were now departing from political dissent. And so when the synod met, who is going to be the clerk, who's going to be recognized as legitimate members of the synod? A large body of the Synod said the men who are under suspension cannot be seated as members of the court. And they insisted anyway. And the moderator, who was on that new side, took the podium, and John McLeod sat before the clerk's book and proceeded with the meeting of Synod, at which time about half of the Synod walked out of the building where the meeting was held and convened in another building and convened the Synod, which they claimed to be the legitimate continuation of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America. And so that's how the split took place. I have a general theory about church divisions. It doesn't apply to every case, but it often is the case. Splits happen when there is a serious disagreement and then some kind of disorderly action. And it usually takes both of those things to bring about a split. Not always, but it's often the case. And that was the case here. I'm not sure how they would have resolved who is to be seated, but it was not done in an orderly way. And so the two churches continued, New Light, not practicing political dissent, the old light, the RPCNA, continuing to practice it. Do you have questions about that? That could be a bit confusing, but Kevin?
Do you know the history behind why Wiley changed his mind? What precipitated the change?
Well, I only know a general answer, and not from anything written that he, in which he disclosed the way he was thinking. But there have now been 20 years and more of experience of living under the government, and I think that was a favorable experience from his standpoint, and so he kept thinking about it, and he did. In fact, I don't know the reason for his changing his mind. I do remember in the debate about political dissent in the 1960s, Dr. Voss was a part of the committee that was working on the revision of the chapters in the testimony and advocating change, Dr. J.G. Voss. And in the debate in Synod, he began to be challenged in quite a personal way by another member of Synod who raised up to him his ordination vows. When you were ordained in this church, did you not promise such and such? And Dr. Voss rather calmly replied, "Well, I guess if a man keeps thinking for 30 years, he might change his mind on some points." And coming from Dr. Voss, who is no slight theologian, that was an impressive response to me. And I suspect, I'm not saying Wiley was right, but something he kept thinking for those intervening years. And he did, in fact, change his mind. Well, I've talked about the Civil War, and in 1863, the Synod actually approved an oath of loyalty for soldiers who would serve in the Civil War. That's on page 58 in Carson. In 1863, a large committee was appointed to answer three specific inquiries made of Synod. In answer to the second of these queries, Synod adopted a form of oath promising loyalty to the country, but not to the Constitution. So making a distinction, I'm loyal to the country, not to the Constitution. The wording was this: "I do swear by the living God that I will be faithful to the United States and will aid and defend them against the armies of the Confederate States, yielding all due obedience to military orders." And after the war, there was a reaffirmation of dissent, but no discipline for those who had participated in the war. And then in 1871, and I will close with this for tonight, as the church for the first time in the New World engaged in covenanting, that is, in drawing up a new covenant, there was included a section that dealt with relation to the government. And it included this: "We will pray and labor for the peace and welfare of our country and for its reformation by a constitutional recognition of God as the source of all power, of Jesus Christ as the ruler of nations, and of the Holy Scriptures as the supreme rule and of the true Christian religion. And we will continue to refuse to incorporate by any act with the political body until this blessed reformation has been secured. And so in a document, Covenant of 1871, which expressed, I believe, a strong consensus in the church in 1871, which continued for the next 100 years, the Covenant of 1871 really shaped the thinking of the church for the next 100 years. They included this statement about political dissent, thinking about the influence of this covenant for the next 100 years. There's a paragraph in it that some of you may know by memory, because for a long time it was used as a pledge in young people's meetings. And it goes like this: aiming to live for the glory of God as our chief end, we will, in reliance upon God's grace and feeling our inability to perform any spiritual duty in our own strength, diligently attend to searching the scriptures, religious conversation, the duties of the closet, the household, the fellowship meeting, and the sanctuary, and will seek in them to worship God in spirit and in truth. We do solemnly promise to depart from all iniquity and to live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world, commending and encouraging by our example temperance, charity, and godliness. That was known as the CYPU Pledge, Covenant or Young People's Union Pledge, and it's a paragraph from the Covenant of 1871. With that, we'll stop.